Okay, this middle chapter of the 3 for Unit 4, 5 is called Mendel and the Gene Idea. Mendel is the surname of Gregor Mendel, who was a monk. Anyone know him from this picture? Which one is Gregor Mendel? Is he famous enough for people to spot?
Is he the one standing second from the right?
Exactly, yes. He's the one right here. That's Gregor Mendel. And he was not appreciated during his lifetime, but now, after his death, he's recognized as the father of modern genetics. Because without having any idea what DNA is or what chromosomes are, in the 1800s, he figured out basically how genetics works and never did ever learn about DNA or anything. He just figured it out because he was a very careful scientist, which was a rare thing in his day for biologists. Biology, for much of its history as a science, was largely descriptive. So there were a bunch of naturalists who were biologists who just liked to go out and find new species and describe all of the living things that exist in a given area, geographic area, which is an important thing. I'm just saying it was mostly a descriptive science and not an experimental one. And even the biologists that were experimental for most of biological history didn't really have an appreciation for the importance of statistics. So they didn't understand why it was important to conduct experiments with large sample sizes and to do them over and over in order to get robust statistics. Nowadays, things are different. We know the importance of that. Well, Mendel, thankfully, was very careful. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been able to figure out what he did figure out. If we look at slide 2, we can see his basic technique. He lived in Europe, in the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the time. Anyway, the fact that he was a monk probably helped, because he was able to devote a lot of time to very hard work, very tedious work with pea plants. He used pea plants for 7 major experiments that were conducted basically the same way, but they all were different with respect to what he cared about in each experiment. We'll talk more about that in a minute. But he used the same technique for all of them. Pea plants are examples of plants that the individuals have both sexual parts to them. That's not true for all species. But a flower, in flowering plants, which are most of the plants nowadays, the flower is the sexual organ of the plant. And there's a female part of a flower is called a carpel. The male parts are called stamens, and at the ends of stamens, that's where pollen gets released. Pollen contains sperm cells. Pollen sticks to the sticky stigma or end of a carpel, the female part, and that has to happen before fertilization can occur. But anyway, in plants that have both parts, male and female, it would be possible for the male part to pollinate the female part within the same individual. Self-pollination, in other words. Well, one of the tasks of Mendel, one of the things he had to be very careful about, was he needed to be the boss of which individuals crossed with which other individuals. He had to make sure he was the boss of who the parents were. So he had to prevent this cross-fertilization. And he did this by carefully going flower to flower and snipping off the stamens so that that pollen couldn't reach the female part of that flower. And he would then go to whatever he chose as the male parent, carefully brush the pollen from their stamens and then put it on to the females he was choosing as the mother, the female parent. Okay? And he did this hundreds or thousands of times for each of his 7 experiments, which is a lot harder than I just made it sound because, well, I'll get into that in a minute. Anyway, these are pea plants. So if this crossing, this artificial crossing that he used with scissors and brush, works, which it doesn't always work, but when it works, there's successful fertilization, in other words, and that produces the fruit, which is the pea pod, with however many peas in it. Each pea is one individual. So each pea is genetically different from all the other peas. They're like siblings are for humans. Even though they're the same parents, they're different genetically. Well, anyway, these pea plants are not, these peas, I mean, are not, they're just seeds. They're not adult pea plants. So in order to see any of his results, even if everything went right up to getting to the peas, he then would have to plant the peas and wait until the next season for them to come up and become adults that he could look at the characteristics of. Well, all of that takes a long time. So it took many years and very, very careful work to do all of this. But what we see here in the parents that he's choosing, that's called the P generation, the parental generation, but P for short. The offspring of the two parents, and he's not just using two parents, he's using two parents times many times, you know, a lot of different parents. But anyway, the offspring of the parental generation is called the F1 generation, the first filial generation. Filial is just a word that means of offspring. Okay? That's just some terminology. Well, if we go to 3, we can see results for just one of his 7 major experiments. But before we get into the particulars of the experiment, I need to talk about something that's important terminologically. In everyday life, you know, we're familiar with the words characteristic and trait. And in everyday life, we use those words basically interchangeably. But they are not interchangeable in genetics. They are different things. So it's important to understand the difference between them. And the best way is to just give you an example rather than to try to tell you the difference. A characteristic is anything that you can describe about an individual. But a trait is a specific value of that characteristic. And hair color in humans could be an example. Hair color would be an example of a characteristic. But we know that there's not just one possible hair color in humans, right? So brown is one trait of the characteristic hair color. Blonde is another trait of that same characteristic, and so on. Does that make the difference clear? Okay, well here, in this experiment of Mendel's, well, I said that there were 7 major experiments conducted the same way, but what makes them different experiments is that in each of the 7, he chose a different characteristic to pay attention to, and that's the only thing that he paid attention to in that experiment. But each experiment involved its own plot of land with its own plants growing separately from all the other experiments. What is the characteristic in this one? Flower color, yes. Not purple, not white. Those are traits. Purple and white are the 2 traits of flower color, and that's the only thing he cared about in this set of plants, not how tall they were or anything else. All right, but another difficulty he had to deal with is that to start, even before he could start the experiments, he had to make sure he was dealing with true breeding individuals. A true breeding individual is one that whatever its traits are, if it's crossed with another true breeder of the same trait, they will produce only offspring with that trait. And that takes generations of doing just preliminary work before you realize before you can be sure, I'm never getting anything but purple flowers with these. So they're true breeding purple flowered individuals, similarly with the white ones. Okay, so that took years probably before he could even start his experiments. Anyway, what we have here is a cross. We call this a cross because you're crossing two parents. And it specifically is a hybrid cross, which is not the only kind of cross, but a hybrid cross is so-called, hybrid meaning a mixture. It's called a hybrid cross because one of the two parents is different in its trait compared to the other parent. All right? Now, even more specifically, this is an example of a monohybrid cross. Mono, of course, means one, right? It's a monohybrid cross because the mono aspect of that is that he's paying attention to exactly one characteristic, and that's it. Flower color in this example. Okay, that's the mono part of monohybrid. The hybrid part of monohybrid means that one of the parents has one trait of that characteristic, and the other parent has the other trait for that same characteristic. So specifically, flower color for the characteristic, purple for one trait in one parent, white for the other trait and the other parent. And they're both true breeders. Okay, so that's the P generation, a purple-flowered individual crossed with a white-flowered individual. And you don't get the results immediately. You have to wait for the peas to be produced. You have to plant them, and then those have to grow up to become the F1 generation with their own flowers. And you can look at them. Well, pause here for a second and think about what humans have known for thousands of years, namely that sexual species have offspring that are kind of a mixture of traits of both parents. We not only know this from our own species, but we know it from animals and plants that we've raised for centuries, for thousands of years. So that's known. Think about what that means, though, or think about what the prediction would be if you interview these humans throughout history. Knowing that offspring are kind of like a mixture of both parents, you might predict that the offspring of a purple-flowered and a white-flowered individual would be a flower color that is partly between purple and white, purplish-white, right? Or a paler purple would make sense, right? Well, that's not what Mendel found. And this is why it's important to do it hundreds of times, because he did it hundreds or thousands of times. And every one of the individuals in the F1 generation, the offspring of the purple and the white, was not only purple, but completely purple, just as purple as the purple parent was.
Doesn't that mean the allele that comes from purple is dominant?
Well, he had no idea about an allele or even a gene or even DNA. But yeah, that's the explanation now. He just had to deal with what he knew, which is what this trait is the same as one of the traits of the parent, fully the same. Okay? So that's surprising in itself, based on the idea that parents mix their traits to make their offspring. But he didn't stop there, thankfully. He had the insight to say, well, what if I then cross F1s with other F1s? In other words, brother and sister get together, or he got them together, to produce the F2 generation in the next year. And when he did that, he found what you see here. White-flowered individuals suddenly appeared, even though none of their parents was white at all, right? Their parents were the F1 generation, which were all purple. But there were some white ones in the F2 generation. And not only that, but this is truly why it was important to have big sample sizes, because if he did this just one time, he wouldn't know this. But since he did it hundreds of times, he noticed that the ratio of the purple-flowered individuals to the white-flowered individuals was almost exactly 3-1. And so that's interesting in itself. But the white flowers, the white trait, appeared to be hidden for a generation, right? And then reemerge in the F2. And that's why we call this white trait in this example a recessive trait. Recessive is the adjective form of recede, which means to hide. The other trait, the purple one in this example, is a dominant trait. It dominates over the recessive trait. The dominance is such that if an organism has, as we'll see, alleles for both of them, one of each, a dominant and a recessive, that dominant allele will dominate over the recessive allele, and therefore the trait itself, which is the phenotype, will be the dominant phenotype. This explains why all the F1 generations were purple and fully purple, because they got a purple version of the gene from one parent and a white version of the gene from the other parent, but the purple gene version completely dominates over the white gene version. And since they all had one of each, it's the purple one that determines their phenotype. That's why they were all fully purple. Okay, so this 3-1 ratio in the F2 generation, 3-1 dominant to recessive ratio of phenotypes, that's a phenotypic ratio. It's a famous Mendelian ratio that he wouldn't have recognized if he had only done this a few times with each experiment. Notice those are real numbers, 705 to 224. He was using a lot of plants. Well, slide 4 summarizes all 7 of his major experiments. And like I said, they're all conducted the same way as far as crossing them with the scissors and the paintbrush. The difference is that in each one, which is a different plot of land, he paid attention to only one characteristic that was different from all the other 6 experiments. So the flower color one we just looked at. But he did the same thing for flower position, seed color, seed shape, pod color, and stem length. All right, and it didn't matter what the characteristic was he was paying attention to. If he did it the same way and went all the way through to the F2 generation, he always got the same 3-1 ratio of dominant trait to recessive trait. So this basically told him, logically, even though he had no idea about DNA, is that because it's happening in these discrete mathematical ratios, it's reasonable to assume that there are particles from parents being passed on. In other words, there is a particle of inheritance, which I think is exactly what he called it, having no idea what a gene is. Nowadays we call them genes, but he didn't know what that was. He just... It's consistent with his findings, though. Now, he also probably at least partially got lucky, because every one of his 7 experiments in which he paid attention to just one characteristic at a time, for all of those, the subjects he was using, these pea plants, the population, not an individual, but the population of the plants featured exactly 2 traits for the characteristic, which is not always true in nature, just like the hair color example I gave you. There's more than 2 colors of hair, right? Well, in pea plants, there's only purple and white with the ones he was using. No other possibilities. Similarly for all these others. It was one or the other, no other possibilities. And that's a good thing luck-wise, because with more than two traits, it becomes a lot more mathematically complicated to figure out. And he probably wouldn't have figured things out if he had chosen other ones. And we'll talk about, well, that's just one example of what we call non-Mendelian genetics. Mendelian genetics, which of course is named in his honor, refers to the situation in which you have exactly two traits for whatever characteristic you're paying attention to, two possible traits in the population. I'll give you a better definition of Mendelian genetics in a little bit, but that's go ahead.
Is that like only for the F2 generation?
F2, exactly. The F1 generation is all 100% dominant trait because of the dominance, right?
Yeah, but did he do the F2 generation and found that ratio to be true or not?
Well, I don't know what if he went beyond F2, but if so, the ratio does not recur after that. It's new ratios after that. I just don't know whether he'd bother doing anything beyond F2. Let's go to 5. And these blue sausage-shaped things are chromosomes. And you can see it's a homologous pair. So what ploidy must we be talking about? Well, diploidy, right? For there to be homologous chromosomes, that means there's two of each type. Now, it happens to be from a pea plant, and I don't know what the N of pea plant peas are, but we don't care about any of the other chromosomes, even though they exist, of course. This is just the only chromosome that includes the gene that controls flower color. All right, so we're with that same experiment that we looked at before. But there's a couple things to say about this, definition-wise. A gene, remember, is simply a sequence of DNA that's a subset of the overall long sequence that we call a chromosome. But what makes it functionally a gene, separate from other sequences, is that it's enough DNA nucleotides to code for one mRNA, right? Which then can be translated into one polypeptide. Well, it's the proteins that actually give the color to the flower. But the genes are indirectly responsible because they control the mRNA that can be produced. Anyway, that's what a gene is. That should be review at this point. Any given gene, though, as a subsequence of the bigger sequence, is somewhere in that sequence, of course. In other words, any given gene has a position on a chromosome that it's part of. And the name for the position of a particular gene is locus. Same root as in location. All right, so we talk about a gene locus. That's not a structure. A gene locus is simply the position on the chromosome that is occupied by a specific gene. And the gene locus for the flower color gene is right here on just the only chromosome of pea plants that has that locus. Okay, so that's one thing, just a definition of locus. The other important definition is allele, which I was giving you earlier today in the lab. A gene corresponds to a characteristic, as I've defined it genetically. All right? An allele, or alleles, I should say, alleles are different variations of the same gene. So the allele that results in white flowers is an allele of the flower color gene. But so is the allele that results in purple flowers. Okay? So you can have multiple alleles for the same gene. That's why you had upper and lowercase letters on your laminated strips. But there's a correspondence that you should keep track of. As I said a little bit ago, a gene corresponds to a characteristic. And that's why we call it, in this case, the flower color gene, because flower color is the characteristic. Alleles, which are specific versions of that gene, correspond to traits of that characteristic. And that's why we call alleles after not the characteristic, but traits, right? There's a purple version and there's a white version of the alleles for flower color. Everyone get what I'm saying here? The correspondence? Okay. Well, another thing that's shown by this diagram is that any given diploid individual is, of course, going to have two alleles for a given gene, because a diploid individual, by definition, has two of that chromosome that is carrying that gene. So there's two total alleles in a diploid individual for your gene of interest. In this case, it would be the flower color gene. But there's three possible ways that you can have two alleles. One allele's on one homolog, the other allele's on the other homolog. There's three ways that can happen, though. If you were assuming that, as Mendel did, that's what I was talking about on luck, if you're assuming that there are only two possible alleles in the population, then there's three possible ways that an individual, a diploid individual, can have two alleles. One possibility is using the flower color example, to have both of your alleles be the purple version. Another possibility is to have both of your alleles be the white version. And then the only other possibility is to have one purple and one white. Okay? One of those three has to be true if you have two total alleles. And there's only two possible types in the population. So those possibilities allow us to categorize things and give them names. So if you have an individual in which both of the two alleles that it has for the gene of interest are the same as each other, then we call that individual homozygous. Homo means same. On the other hand, if an individual has one of each, in other words, the two alleles are not the same as each other, then that individual is heterozygous. Hetero means different. Okay, but notice I said there's three overall possibilities. There's two terms here, but three possibilities. And that's because there's two different ways to be homozygous. Right? One way is to have both of your alleles be the dominant version, purple in this case, and the other way is to have both of your alleles be the recessive version, white in this case. So that's why we don't use the word homozygous by itself. It doesn't give us enough information. We have to pair it up with either dominant or recessive. So there are homozygous dominant individuals, and there are homozygous recessive individuals. Heterozygous, on the other hand, gives you enough information, so we don't bother to qualify that phrase. It's just the word by itself. Heterozygous by itself tells you one of the alleles is dominant, the other one is recessive. And that's your three possible possibilities for any given single gene. And in genetic experiments, just like in Mendel's, you usually restrict your attention to a single characteristic and therefore, by correspondence, a single gene. You don't care at all what the other genes are doing. Okay? Okay, let's go to 6 then. This is the same exact experiment we've already looked at, But there's some information added that will hopefully make things clear, and we have to get through some more definitions. So now that we know about gene loci, which is the plural of locus, and alleles, we can talk about genotypes and phenotypes in more detail than I already told you in lab today. Remember what I said in lab, though. A genotype is a symbolic representation of the alleles in an individual's cells, in the cells of an individual. But, like I said a minute ago, we are ignoring all the other genes in the organism. All we care about is the one gene that corresponds to the one characteristic that we're paying attention to. In this example, flower color. All right? Well, this is a true breeding purple flowered individual. I told you that phrase, true breeding, before. True breeding is just another way of saying homozygous. So a true breeding purple flowered individual is specifically homozygous dominant, because purple is dominant over white. The true breeding white flowered individual is homozygous recessive. The reason they're true breeding is because they have only one kind of allele. They have two of them, right, like any diploid does, but they have only one kind. And therefore, doesn't matter which one of those you choose in meiosis to pass on in your gametes, it's going to be that one type, either purple in one from one parent or white from the other parent. That's why they're true breeding. Okay, but notice the pairs of P's, the letter P, not the fruit, where it's marked as genetic makeup. Genetic makeup here refers to genotype. And genotypes are always strings of symbols. They're not phrases. Well, there's, unfortunately, as we'll see, there have been multiple different so-called standards. If we're truly standards, there would really only be one of them. But anyway, there's different ways that we standardize these genotypes. But one way, shown here, is that we use a letter that denotes the dominant trait. And in this case, purple is dominant over white. That's where the letter P comes from. Okay, that's why we designate alleles of the flower color gene with P's, because P stands for purple. But somewhat confusingly, when you're first learning this, is that we use a letter P to denote both purple and white. We don't use W's. We use P's only, just so that no matter what the genotype is, we can tell that purple is the dominant one over W. P always reminds us of that. All right, but there's two possible alleles, a purple version and a white version. And that's where we use the case, uppercase or lowercase, to make the difference. So it's always a P standing for the dominant one, but it's an uppercase P if it's the purple version, the dominant version, and it's a lowercase p if it's the recessive version, the white version. Okay? Well, this is a true breeding purple flowered individual, which is another way of saying that it's homozygous dominant. And the genotype for a homozygous dominant purple flowered individual is upper P. Alright? And the homozygous recessive white flowered individual has the genotype lower P. Each of those individual letter P's is an allele on one of the two homologs that individual has in its diploid genome. Is all of this making sense? Okay, well, if they're going to be prospective parents, then there needs to eventually be fertilization, which is the fusion of two gametes, as we learned, right? You can't have fusion of gametes until the prospective parents first make gametes. And what process is used in diploid organisms to make gametes? Meiosis. So meiosis has to happen to produce these gametes. And what is the really big deal about meiosis? It halves the ploidy, exactly. You have to have the ploidy because you know it's going to double in fertilization and you want to just get back to where you were rather than truly doubling it. So you have it first and then let it double back to diploidy only. Okay? Now, when meiosis happens, as through how we've discussed it already, for any given single gamete, which is just one of the cells that get produced in meiosis, just one of the two chromosomes of the homologous pair it started with gets chosen for that cell. And therefore, just one of the two alleles being carried by those two chromosomes gets chosen for that individual gamete. You following me? In other words, meiosis randomly chooses one of these two alleles in the genotype from the parent to make a gamete. Well, if you have a homozygous parent, then it doesn't matter which one you choose, right? This one is going to definitely choose an uppercase P. Doesn't matter which one it chooses. That's why the only kind of gamete it can make is an uppercase P gamete. Notice, by the way, that the genotype for a gamete is just one letter in length. It's two letters in length, the genotype, for the parent, because the parent is diploid. Two P's for a diploid. The gametes are haploid, and so the haploid genotype is just one letter long. All right? This is why they're called homozygous. They can make only one kind of zygote because they can pass on only one kind of allele. That's the only kind of allele they have. Same with the white one, only it's lowercase p. Now, if these two gametes get together in fertilization, that's going to produce a diploid zygote, right? And specifically, it's going to be a zygote with a diploid genotype that is uppercase P, lowercase p. Because it got one from one parent and the other from the other parent. All right? So this explains Mendel's results for the F1 generation. The only possibility for all the F1s is for each of them to be uppercase P, lowercase p, because those are the only sperm and eggs that those parents could make. And this explains, therefore, why 100% of the F1 generation had the same phenotype. The phenotype is the actual description of the trait. Phenotype and trait basically mean the same thing. But we don't use symbols for phenotype. We use descriptive phrases like purple-flowered or white-flowered. They were all purple-flowered because they were all heterozygous, uppercase P, lowercase P. And because of the dominance of purple over white, that means a heterozygous individual is going to have the dominant trait, which in this case is purple. Okay, that's why there's no whites. Well, another thing to say along the same lines of dominance is that because of dominance of one allele over the recessive allele, the only way that an individual can have the recessive trait is to not have any dominant alleles in its genotype. In other words, to have both of its two alleles be the recessive type. Because dominance means all it takes is one allele of the dominant type to make you have the dominant trait. This explains another one of its results. This is why these F1s, which had only one uppercase P in their genome, only one purple allele, they were still fully purple, just as much as the upper P parent, because it only takes one because of dominance. Okay, but this explains why the only way to be white is to be homozygous recessive, lower P. That's impossible for the F1s, because you're definitely going to get an uppercase P from one of the parents. Okay, now if we do the F2 generation, what we are crossing now are not these original parents, we're crossing two of the F1s, each of which is uppercase P, lowercase p in its genotype. Well, that brings us to the Punnett square, which is what the name of this is, this figure on the bottom. It's a Punnett square. This is a Punnett is named after a dead Englishman who started doing this. A Punnett square is really just a shorthand device drawn like this. It's a shorthand device to represent, though, a real biological occurrence. What is the biological occurrence that it's representing? Occurrence. What process, what biological process is being represented by a Punnett square?
Fertilization.
Exactly. Remember that fertilization is fusion of two gametes, one from each of the two parents. Well, that's what fertilization by itself is. But parents can make, in certain cases, more than one kind of gamete for the one characteristic you're talking about, right? These true breeders couldn't because they're true breeding. But these heterozygous F1s can make two different kinds of gametes each with respect to flower color. That's all you're caring about is flower color. All right? And that's because they're heterozygous. They have one of each allele, and therefore you can randomly choose one or the other with meiosis. So a Punnett square, yes, is a representation of all the possible gametes that can get together for any two specific parents, paying attention to just a single characteristic at a time. All right. Now, on the above the box and to one side of the box, the left in this example, there are these gametes that are represented. So a Punnett square exhaustively lists, in other words, every possible gamete that one parent can make and every possible gamete that the other parent can make. And I'm not talking about the nearly infinite number of gametes they can really make, because we're ignoring all the other DNA, right? All we care about is the DNA for flower color, and there's two possibilities for each of these. Anyway, those gametes are listed above and to one side. What do the boxes inside the Punnett square represent biologically? Well, what do we call that? Zygotes, right. Each box represents a possible zygote that these two particular parents can produce. And as you already learned, a zygote is produced when a particular sperm and a particular egg get together and fuse, right? Well, in a Punnett square, that's simply a matter of getting together an egg from a row and a sperm from a column and combining them. Since these are all the eggs that mother could produce, and these are all the sperm that father could produce, the Punnett square is every possible combination of the two. And now, importantly, there's four boxes in this Punnett square, but that does not at all mean that these two parents are going to have four offspring. They might have one, they might have 1,000. What this says is that these are the four possibilities. So however many they have, each one of them is one of these four possibilities. Okay? Well, notice that because of dominance, it takes only one uppercase P to make the flowers completely purple. And three of the four possibilities have at least one uppercase P. The only one that doesn't is the one that has two lowercase p's. That's a homozygous recessive offspring. That's the only way you can be recessive in your phenotype, is to be homozygous recessive. So this mathematically explains Mendel's findings in the F2. Regardless of how many offspring are produced, 3/4 of them are expected to be dominant. 1/4 is supposed to be recessive. That's the 3-to-1 ratio that he found over and over. Well, if you only have one offspring, it's either purple or white, right? And you have no idea what that ratio would be. But if you're careful and do it hundreds or thousands of times, that 3-to-1 ratio is going to be noticed. And the more offspring you have, the closer you get to the exactly 3-to-1. That's the power of large sample sizes that he was careful about. Okay, so that explains the 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio that he found. And that's how a Punnett square works. Slide 7 gives you this phenotypic ratio on the left. This is for the F2, right? 3 dominant phenotype to 1 recessive phenotype. This is the ratio of phenotypes or traits. That's why we call it a phenotypic ratio. But there's also what we call a genotypic ratio, a ratio of genotypes. And that involves 3 numbers in this case, not 2. It's a 1-to-2-to-1 ratio for genotypes. And that's because there's 2 ways that you can have the dominant phenotype, right? You can be homozygous dominant, or you can be heterozygous dominant. And let me just quickly go back to the Punnett squares to show you that all 3 of these purple-flowered ones, of course, have the same phenotype. But this one is the only one that is homozygous. You have to get together a dominant egg and a dominant sperm to make a homozygous dominant zygote. These 2 on the diagonal that are purple are heterozygous because they got one purple from one parent and a white from the other parent. And it doesn't matter which one they get the purple from. Either way, they're heterozygous. But what you can see here is that genotypically, it's a 1 homozygous dominant to 2 heterozygous to 1 homozygous recessive ratio, which is exactly what is recapitulated in slide 7. Okay, 1-to-2-to-1. But the 2 and 1 for purple add up to 3 in the phenotype, 3-to-1. All right, is that a good place to stop? Yeah, that's a little bit different topic, so we'll stop there.